This is the workshop on the seven laws of teaching. I took pretty much every educational course that the University of Idaho had to offer as I was doing my undergrad and then my grad work there. And there were a lot of books that we were to read on education, methodology, not so much on philosophy. They were a little lean on that. And I can tell you that this brief little book, The Seven Laws of Teaching by John Milton Gregory, is hands down the best, most succinct book on instruction on teaching I have ever seen. And that includes the 28 years I've been at Logos. I have never seen a better description and instruction, not just a description, but instruction on what the whole art of teaching entails. So that's meant to be a wholehearted endorsement of this. I hope you picked up on it. A little bit about John Milton Gregory. He was born in 1822, died in 1898. He was a teacher at various times, a lawyer, a pastor, but his main passion was education. He headed a classical school, as it was referred to, in Detroit. I'm originally from Ann Arbor, Michigan, so this is kind of near and dear to me. He became the state superintendent of education in Michigan. Eventually, he was asked to be the president of Kalamazoo College, in a town by the same name. Well, just Kalamazoo. He also headed and organized what is now known as the University of Illinois, and he was there for 13 years. In 1884, he first wrote this book, Seven Laws of Teaching. So it precedes, I don't know if you've been acquainted with some of the other more recent versions of laws or rules for teaching, but he preceded pretty much everybody in doing that, even Sayers, if I can be so bold. But he wrote the book, and it was largely for Sunday school teachers. If you read it, that becomes very clear. He makes no apology or embarrassment or anything that this was aimed at Sunday school teachers. Now, he does broaden it, of course, and says, especially as he gets into the laws themselves, that it's applicable to all who will instruct. Basically, he says, wherever good teaching takes place, these seven laws are there. And that's a real important note, because there's a temptation, I think particularly within the classical school movement, to feel or suspect that we have some sort of secret formula, sort of a McClassical or, you know, Kentucky Fried, you know, education that we can pass on and only we know the secrets. Well, that's, you know, I trust you've been around long enough to realize that's hardly the case. We are poor archaeologists rediscovering what's been buried under layers and layers of dust and dirt by previous generations. That's what we're doing in a classical education. Okay, we're blowing that dust off and trying to see what's there and trying to learn what other ages knew. Well, pretty much that's what Gregory was doing. He was recognizing what always takes place, wherever it takes place, in good teaching. So it's not if you're going to be a teacher, you have to know the seven laws, and it's some sort of a secret club. Okay, it's a good idea to know the seven laws and recognize what happens in good teaching, but it's not Gregory's invention. Okay, he didn't come up with this, he just organized them. Anyway, he wrote it in 1884. And it was then, kind of, I find a little ironically, purged, that's how I would put it, they would say revised, by some folks at the University of Illinois, the school he was president of for a number of years, after his death, about 15 years after his death, in 1913. And really what was done there was it was expurgated of essentially all biblical or Christian references. Okay? It was almost, you know, whitewashed out. All references to Scripture or Christianity or the Lordship of Christ were removed. I don't know who these people were. It's better I don't. But they did that. And sadly, in one sense, but still, we got the blessing of it anyway. When Logos began in 1981, very shortly thereafter, one of our board members came across the Seven Laws of Teaching, as published at that time by Baker House, and it was the 1913 edition. That was the only one in print. And so we grabbed it, read it, and it still had, you know, it just had a lot of power. It was a very succinct, excellent summation of good teaching. And so we used it literally for the next, oh, what would it be, 20-some years. I gave this talk at a number of conferences back in the 90s, thinking, to all my knowledge, that that was the only version there was. Okay, I knew from his own testimony that Gregory was a Christian, but it never occurred to me that this version might have had some tinkering with it. Well, in 2002, at a conference for ACCS, just like this, I was going to say a mysterious young man in white, but I don't know who it was, but a gentleman came up and gave one of our staff members a photocopy version of the original 1884 edition. And it didn't take much perviewing of it to realize what was there that wasn't in the 1913 edition. And we got very excited. It was somewhat dismaying to realize we'd been using, you know, flat root beer for years. And we got the taste of the real thing. Wow! It was delightful to see how much Gregory integrated scriptural references and knowledge into his book. It just makes sense, of course, that we should have figured that out. It was for Sunday school teachers and not one reference to the Lord. But we weren't that quick. Anyway, so we were thrilled. And with the cooperation of Veritas Press, Logos had it published. You can now buy it in a nice form, either from us or from Veritas. And all the references that Gregory makes to Scripture are annotated so you can see where they're found. And he also makes some references to a number of the ancients, if you will, predecessors in education. And you can see where those quotes came from. So there's some additional information there for you. Anyway, so we were thrilled. So now you can get the real deal. I just heard from one gentleman that you can also get the original 84 edition online for free. I probably shouldn't tell you that, but I will, full disclosure. But it won't look as nice when you download it, you know, so there you go. Well, how about the myth or the idea or the consequences of teaching laws? If you've gone to a college of education, and unless maybe a Christian college, but most of us would have gone to a secular college of education, this should sound, especially if it's the first time you're hearing it, almost anathema, almost just, that doesn't make any sense. Are you saying there are really laws related to teaching? I thought teaching was an art. I thought teaching was from the soul, and, you know, kind of, it's what I mean it to be. Sort of like art. I went through that too. I'm just kind of a mess. But my college experience was largely whatever you want it to be, you know, education and art. But there are laws, frankly, in art, and there are laws in teaching. And that is a news item, and maybe not a welcome one, to most modern educators. That sounds somewhat anathema. It sounds somewhat heinous. How can you have a law about teaching? We're all individuals, blah, blah, blah. Okay. Well, there is this myth that good teaching kind of just happens. It's largely personality-driven, teacher-dependent. Okay, it just kind of happens. Teachers are largely born, not made, type of idea. And I'll grant you, there is some truth to that, as there is in most falsehoods. There's some truth to that. Okay, I really do believe, both scripturally and in practice, that there is a gift of teaching. There is an ability to teach that comes through. But I also believe that everyone who wants to teach can get better at it. Okay? Especially by using these laws. Or the idea that there is a right or wrong way to teach. So you have the myth that it just happens. Or the idea that there is no right or wrong way to teach. The whole idea, of course, is that if you're a teacher, the main point is that you're sincere. Sincerity is a very important characteristic these days. Toleration is another one, but sincerity carries a lot of weight. It shouldn't, but it does. You can be sincerely very wrong. We probably all have been. Sincerely wrong. Okay, so sincerity really doesn't get you very far. But that's the idea, that if you are sincere and you're a good-hearted teacher, you should not be corrected. There is, you know, you did it the way you believed was right, and therefore it must have been okay. All right? We don't accept that in any other avenue of life. Try explaining that to the officer that stopped you on the highway. I just really felt 70 was what I needed to do. It won't work. So Gregory's proposition is that there is, or there are, laws, not just good ideas, but laws to teaching, and he compares them to what he would say are nature's laws, or God's laws concerning creation. Okay? The laws of physics, or the laws of nature. Here's a warning. I like Gregory. I've never met him, but I think I would like him anyway. But like every man, he gets off in some places that he shouldn't, and we all are like that. He was certainly a man of his time in that sense. And if you picture him writing in the late 1880s, and you've studied history a little bit, you know that that was a time of incredible surging of modernistic Enlightenment ideas. Okay, Marxist thinking is coming in at that point. Darwin is taking off in some of the schools. It was just a real crazy time, all right? It was the post-war between the states. There were just a lot of major changes culturally happening in our country, okay? A major dependence on science or a feeling that science was essentially not quite the savior of mankind. Gregory knew the difference there, but definitely the way to look at the world. So he gives a little more credit to science and natural laws, as he would call them, than I feel comfortable with. God is the sustainer of his creation. He is not. We are not deists. I don't think Gregory was either, but he kind of talks like one at some points. Anyway, that's just a little bit of warning. But there are certain orders, of course, that God put into his universe that we call natural law. So, for instance, Gregory would say that these laws of teaching are as very real as the law of gravity. Okay, in the same way that a glass jar doesn't respond well to dropping it on concrete, okay, students don't respond well when the laws are not followed. Learning doesn't take place. That's the weight he gives to these laws, and I would concur. There are certain things about the way people learn, about the way people should teach, that when they're not done, good teaching doesn't happen and good learning doesn't happen. It's just that simple. Okay? Now, obviously, there are positive consequences, too, and that's what we're going to largely look at. Okay. Oh, and I should mention here, I kind of alluded to this before, but I really want to emphasize this. This is not, again, a secret formula. There are teachers across the world, across all time, who have done good teaching, accomplished good teaching, who, of course, had never even heard of Gregory. Okay? They just did it. And if we had been there and we put a template, shall we say, of the seven laws to their teaching, we'd go, yep. All right. Well, I'm going to walk us through and maybe more of a trot through these because even though it's a short book, we have even shorter time. So I'm going to walk us through a sample lesson, and I'll get to that in a moment. But I have to throw this in because, well, I probably will never get my doctoral degree, but if I did, I'd try to do it around this. And that is that I believe there's an eighth law, okay? I believe there's an eighth law of teaching. And it's kind of a negative one, so maybe it wouldn't catch on. And that is this. From my own observations of watching teachers over a number of years, here's what I came up with. Unless taught otherwise, teachers will teach the way they were taught. I'll run that by you again because it's kind of fun. Unless taught otherwise, teachers will teach the way they were taught. In other words, particularly this may be to administrators, if your teachers come to you from another school, from another teaching situation, and they are not taught by you or someone qualified to teach a different way, they will teach the way they were taught. It's imprinted. We can't help it. We don't come as a blank slate. We're not Rousseau's tabula rasa. Okay? We have imprinted on us the way we were taught. Whether it was homeschool or public school or Christian school, you were taught in a certain manner. And you don't even have to think about it. Just start teaching. You'll do it. And so that's why I came up with this eighth law. And it really is true. Like I said, it won't go far in getting me a doctoral degree, but that's okay. I like to share that, and I hope that helps. So, in the efforts of trying to teach differently, we need to consider how we teach. Okay, well, we're going to walk through what I'll call a sample lesson in the presidency of Theodore Roosevelt. I just kind of picked that out of the air. Figured, why not? I like the guy. I think he was the best president we've ever had. But other than that, I just thought we'd go ahead and study a little bit about him using these laws. Okay? I hope it helps to give you some framework to hang these on. All right, the first one. The laws themselves are easy to remember. There are seven, like I said. Two of them are personal, the teacher and the student, the two actors. Two of them are mental, the language and the lesson. And three are functional, that you can see happening, in a sense. The teacher's process, the student process, and the review process. Okay, we'll go through these, but that's just a quick summation. Two personal, two mental, and three functional. All right, let's get into the law of the teacher. See, I've left you little blanks, so this is kind of an interactive thing. Kind of fun, huh? Okay, I don't have a PowerPoint, so this way, you know, you can kind of do something fun too. The laws themselves. All right. The teacher, or a teacher, must be one who knows the lesson or truth to be taught. You lose anybody? Okay. Well, of course, yes, it's obvious. And if you haven't read this or gone through the seven laws before, that will be probably the first thing that strikes you. By golly, why is this so famous? When riding a bike, it's important to stay balanced. Oh, write that down. It may seem obvious. Most of these will seem obvious. Maybe not all of them, but most of them will seem obvious. Duh. Might be the reaction. Don't do that out loud. But that could be the reaction. Well, let's not get so hasty. How deep has the teacher studied? Might come to mind. In other words, what does knowing mean? How well does the teacher know? Aha. Is the teacher, for instance, text reliant? Living by the text. I kind of think of this as being a kennel fed situation as opposed to a dog on the run or something. But in other words, a very safe, tidy knowledge, all kept within a very clean hardcover text. And that is the extent of the teacher's knowledge. Not enough. Definitely not enough. You mean a third grader could push my knowledge limits beyond that text? In a heartbeat. You betcha. Now, I'll put a qualifier out here. If you're a first-year teacher, some of this should be taken in small doses. I don't want anybody going and cutting their wrists or, you know, anything terrible like that. Oh, I can never do this. All right. You'll take, if you're a new first-year teacher, trust me on this, 3 years. 3 years before you are kind of on balance. Okay? I've told that to a number of teachers, and, you know, I get different reactions. Great. So my first 2 years are lousy? Well, probably yes. I had to break that to one of my kindergarten teachers, a sweet young thing, recently married and just out of college, and I told her a number of things that weren't going real well in her classroom, and she was in tears. Are you telling me that my 4 years in college of education are largely wasted? Oh, how do I say this? So anyway, yes. So, text reliant or an excited student yourself? Someone who wants to know more, someone who on their own seeks out more knowledge. Even after years of teaching, are you still excited? All right? We've all probably, or a lot of us have seen college professors who have taught the same thing for 25 years, and oh my word, you know, the Energizer Bunny has more life than he does. And you just have the sense that somebody did wind him up and he just performs in front of the classroom. I had a professor like that too. A history professor. I love history. You know, it came as a shock to him during his lectures if someone actually raised their hand. What? Not exactly that passionate continuing learner example. Okay, and you really need to be. By the way, this will mean lots and lots and lots of reading. Lots and lots of reading to know. Well, Gregory breaks his book into a number of things. He has laws and he has rules and violations. Okay, for each section. He has the law, then he has some sample rules and more, in other words, specific applications, kind of breaking down of examples. And then he has some violations. In other words, how this rule or this law more particularly has been violated and is often violated by teachers. And that's the part you start looking at and go, yep, real close on this one. Yeah, that's me. Mm-hmm, yeah. And you get really depressed and, you know, don't want to keep reading. Don't do that. Don't do that. Just take it a little bit at a time. So, for instance, a sample rule is better to know a little well than a lot poorly. Better to know a little well than a lot poorly. A lot of wise people have said that in various ways. Sayers, Lewis have said similar types of things. Draw from a variety of sources for your knowledge, not just the text. And be honest with the kids on your limits. I think this is particularly hard for guys at the secondary level to admit, I don't know. I don't know. Yes, a 10th grader asked me something and I don't know the answer. Far better, Gregory would say, and I think our Lord would too, to be honest and say, well, you know what? I don't really know that. That's a really good question. Let me write that down and I'll find out. Finding out today is a whole lot easier than it was when I started teaching, I can tell you that. Google City, right? Don't trust everything you read, but at least it's an easy source. So find out, but be honest with those kids. A sample violation, basically just repeating what you've been told. Basically repeating what you've been told or taught, and obviously that means without any further investigation on your part. Now, yes, there are some things you can probably take at face value. But, say we're talking about Theodore Roosevelt, just by happenstance. Knowing his life dates and some of the biography dates, what happened when, yes, that's a minimum of knowledge. But how do I, and this all ties into this further laws, how do I excite the kids to be excited about what I know about Theodore Roosevelt? Well, that's going to take a much, much deeper knowledge than I even want them to have when we're all done. You follow me on this? You need to have so much more wealth of knowledge than you're going to impart. And for, here's one of these kind of contradictory things. You're going to, if you're excited as I am about learning about somebody like that, you're going to want to back up the truck, hit the dumper, and let them all have it. Okay, so somewhere in there you need to sort out what they can handle. But that excitement has to be there, and I hope that the more you find out about something, like Theodore Roosevelt, the more you want to know. That's important. Okay, a sample violation, yes, just repeating what you know, and not becoming familiar, re-familiar with the material beforehand. Very personal thing would be, I've given this talk so many times, I probably could have done it without any preparation. But I would have violated the first law. Okay? Becoming re-familiar with what you already think you know. It might happen that you've been wrong for a while. That's always fun to discover. And that's happened to me quite a number of times, actually. All right? Be teaching along and find out that on this worksheet I've used for 13 years, I've got the wrong date for the end of World War II. I tell them the right date, but it's the wrong date on the worksheet. Why? Because I hadn't looked at it in years. I just gave it to the classes. And finally, somebody was brave enough to say, Mr. Garfield, it says September 2nd here. Well, yeah, of course. Oh, okay. Okay. That's, if I'm talking about the beginning of World War II, that's wrong. It was September 1st when Poland was invaded, and September 3rd when the war officially was declared by Britain and France, right? Then it gets really confusing because 6 years later, 1939 to 45, September 2nd is when the Japanese signed the surrender documents, of course. You see how that can happen? So if you just get that little, you know, senior thing going, it can throw you off. So review for yourself, become re-familiar with material you already think you know. Okay, we need to move along. The law of the learner. You've got the teacher knowing her stuff or his stuff. Knows all about TR. The law of the learner. Here it is. A learner, or student, is one who attends with interest to the lesson. Here again is one of the things, I couldn't have figured that out by myself. Who attends with interest to the lesson. I am hoping right now that you are not only attending, that is, faces forward, eyes open, both those things preferably, but even interested in knowing what's coming next. Well, so should your students be. Okay? If they are not attending, they won't learn. We're going deep here. This is PhD stuff for sure. If they're not attending, they won't learn. If they're not interested, they won't retain. If they are not interested, it won't stick. All right? And by the way, if we're not even close to them loving what you love, if they're not attending, they won't learn. If they're not interested, they certainly won't retain. And we're not even close to loving it, which, of course, is where we want to go. Okay? So, obviously, here again, you must be interested. Of course, you're going to be attending, I trust. Well, it depends. Anyway, but you must be interested, far more interested than they are. Your enthusiasm is contagious. I think toward the end of the book, Gregory says, give me a teacher who is, well, shall we say, not well-informed, but is excited. Someone who has enthusiasm. Someone who has, shall we say, charisma. Over some dull, well-endowed, brilliant person. Better, go ahead, give me the guy or the girl who bubbles and says really stupid things, but is excited about what he or she thinks they know, than someone who is really right and correct and dry as toast. Okay, obviously, you shouldn't have to have a dichotomy there. Hopefully, there's some happy marriage. Okay? Okay, so, as he says, you know, or he alludes to, dispassionate discourse sounds and is as fascinating as cold oatmeal. Okay, he didn't say that. I said that. But that's basically the idea. Nobody gets interested by that, even if it's nutritious. You want them to love what you love. And that means, of course, that you need to express it and have it. One of the ways I kind of get their interest, I think, is a number of ways in Theodore Roosevelt, is by giving them, of course, some of these interesting facts of his life, but also by mentioning that they may shake my hand. Wow, that's great. No, this hand has shaken gently the hand of his granddaughter. Okay? That very hand, I met his granddaughter one of them, the daughter of Ethel, his one of his daughters. That's how that works. I'm a history guy, not a biology teacher. And I know that. Anyway, she was at a Theodore Roosevelt Association meeting. Did you know there is one? There's a Theodore Roosevelt Association. I'm a card-carrying member. That's how bad it gets. Anyway, there was a special one in Portland, and that was easier for me to get to. And here was in attendance his granddaughter. And so I made a point, gently, of shaking her hand, because she was, of course, quite elderly. And I had her sign this book and everything. So I tell the kids, you can shake the hand of the lady who sat on TR's lap. Okay. Well, anyway, Gregory then goes into, with this interest thing, several layers. Now, don't lose this. He it sounds a little maybe psychotic or psychologic or something. It sounds a little strange. He says there are three levels of interest: active, passive, and what he calls secondary passive. Okay, that's where it sounds a little strange. Active, of course, you're probably familiar with. If I reached under the podium here, pulled out a burlap sack, threw it on the floor, and out came a boa constrictor, I dare say I'd have the active attention of the front row. Fair enough? Okay, along with some adrenaline. That's kind of fun, but not really what we want to try to do all the time, and you certainly can't sustain it for whatever period of time you've got with the kids. Passive attention is just what it sounds like. Hand on the, head on the hand, eyes are open, head's in the right direction. You know, maybe they're following you, maybe they're just not really there. Secondary passive, he says, is where it doesn't take a lot of attention, or excuse me, a lot of work to stay attentive. Okay, that's the easiest one. That's the one you want to get to, where the kids are partaking mentally with you, but it's not a strain and it's not that kind of act of attention. It's not the Sesame Street, five, 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 kind of thing. All right? I don't know if they still do that, but that's what they used to do, because they were going for this shake 'em up type approach. Okay, well, sample rule is, again, as I said, go for the secondary passive attention, and be aware of what sparks their interest. And we're going to unavoidably have overlaps with other laws here. It is one teaching process. Okay, so there are going to be some overlaps here. But you want to have a knowledge of what sparks their interest. And as we get into the law of the lesson, that's going to be pretty obvious in how to do that. Okay, so you're going for what's interesting to them. A sample violation, of course, is to start or continue work without their attention. Now, there aren't too many teachers, I trust, who would start the lesson when the students are still filing into the room, or continue the lesson when the students are filing out of the room. You wouldn't do that, would you? They might miss something. Right. I've seen that happen with lots of teachers. Not so much maybe the coming in, but definitely the going out. All right? If the clock is right behind you on the wall, clicking down to when the bell rings, oh yeah, you've got their attention. They're staring at the clock, not you, so it's probably not a good place to stand. Or when that bell rings, oh wait, I need to tell you one more thing. You might as well just tell it to an empty room, because that's what you've got, essentially. They are no longer with you. And that sounds so obvious, and yet is a very, very real and very frequent violation. I'm going to throw something else here. Oh, by the way, here's another one he mentions and I think is great. That is assuming that everything you say is really important. Assuming that everything you say is really important. Well, it probably is important to you. I assume that everything about Theodore Roosevelt is important, because it was him. Well, hopefully by the end of our study of his life, the kids will agree with that. But while we're in it, I have a lot of convincing to do. They don't know him. They don't know why they need to know him. And maybe in some cases, they don't want to know him. What do I have to do to get the A? Here's another one. Distracting decor. This is a violation. Distracting decor. I don't want to get too much into this, but think about how your room looks, if especially elementary teachers. Primary colors are not the end of art, if you know what I mean. Nothing necessarily against them, but that's largely the colors in which most elementary decor come in. Primary colors, I'm not really sure why that is. I guess it's cheaper to print. Anyway, there's a whole lot of thought that needs to go into how your room aids the students in not only feeling comfortable, but realizing this is a place of learning and beauty, okay? And I like being here, and yet it's not distracting from what the teacher is trying to do. Little Johnny ADD over here, okay? And you've got things hanging from the ceiling and on the walls and under the desks and in the windows, and you're wondering why he's not following you. He's probably way ahead of you, for one thing. And the other thing is, he's got about 1,000 things he can look at instead of you. That's just a little parenthetical thing. Okay, the law of the language. Now, this is going to seem one of the best ones yet. The language used as a medium between teacher and learner must be common to both. Okay, let's get past what seems to be a rather obvious statement. We're not talking about using English. We're talking about understanding what you're saying and the kids understanding it the same way. Most of you are far too young to remember Art Linkletter. Is he still alive? No, okay. He'd be about 140. Anyway, Art Linkletter had this, I don't know if it was a whole show, but he had this thing, Kids Say the Darndest Things. That was the title of it. Pardon the French. Kids Say the Darndest Things. And what it was essentially having a whole lot of fun with the violation of this law. Children being taught a Bible verse or the Star Spangled Banner or something that we take for granted, and then their interpretation of it was hilarious. Ha 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 ha. Okay, well, actually, it was hilarious. Problem was, they weren't trying to be hilarious. You know what I mean? You know the difference. Kids are most funny, as are adults, when they don't think they are. And children in particular usually are not trying to be funny when they say something like the Lord's Prayer and they get it wrong, and usually quite uniquely wrong. He made a whole show out of that. Well, it can be kind of funny, but it's not very funny when you're trying to teach something properly. So, how do the students understand what you're saying? The words, the phrases, the thoughts you express frequently. I'll give you this illustration because it's always fun to tell her I did it at a conference. Young lady, very, very sharp young lady, in my 10th grade modern history class. And one of the things I do at the end of the year for their final is have a museum, as I call it, of all the artifacts that we looked at during the year. They have to tell me not only what that artifact is, but what does it mean in history. Well, I had a station wagon that I showed them. I have all these model cars, and it's my excuse that I teach from them so I can collect them. So we have this Chevy Nomad, and she wrote everything correct about what it meant. All right? What it meant. The baby boomers in the 1950s needed a larger car for all their children, and so that mom could take dad to the station and then drive to this new supermarket and have room to load groceries and all this stuff. Hence the name Volkswagen. Okay, not as many of you got that as should have. That's very scary. Okay, let's be clear about this. This is me applying the third law. A Volkswagen is a small car. Okay. She was talking about a place for large families, and she even got the whole station thing, taking dad to the train station, and she put Volkswagen. Okay, I thought it was hilarious. All right, somehow that didn't click in that brilliant mind, that there's a big difference between a Volkswagen and a station wagon. So it can happen. A little clarity. Language is the vehicle of knowledge. He said that, I didn't. That's a really good one. Language is the vehicle of knowledge. the suitcase of our instruction. Okay, that was mine. Language is the vehicle of our instruction. It's what carries our thoughts. We better make sure that it's a pretty good package. It's a good vehicle. If I use a TR quote, talk softly but carry a big stick, I can throw that out. That's a very famous saying of his, right? And then tell the kids, that's a very famous saying of his. They write it dutifully down. That's a famous saying of Theodore Roosevelt. What does it mean? Might be worth talking about. And why am I even mentioning it? What's this big stick thing? Or if we talk about, which is an application of it, battleship diplomacy, what does that mean? How do you talk nicely to battleships? You better talk nicely to battleships, that's the thing. All right, so a sample rule. Check with the students. Get from them as full of an answer as you can. Not a yes, no, 27, 1946. Give me a full answer. Answer my question with a full answer. That's a good way to find out what they understand. Require complete thoughts. Writing, of course, is another way of doing that. Sample violation is basically that attendance and compliance don't always mean understanding. They can be dutifully looking at you, they can be dutifully taking notes, and not have a clue what they're writing down. Much of my college career sounds like that. Lights are on, no one's home, that kind of thing. There's also an instinctive fear in many students of asking a dumb question. What did you mean by? So you need to ask the question. Do you know what I mean by? When I say this, what does that mean to you, Sally? Put her on the spot. Okay? So check with them. All right, we need to move along. The law of the lesson. The lesson to be mastered must be explicable in terms of truth already known to the learner. The unknown must be explained by means of the known. Okay? In most problems with the student's understanding, this is the most common. The teacher didn't plan the instruction to link clearly with previous knowledge and built on an absent foundation. Nothing was there. We're just going to plunge right in and go from there. There's no checking with previous knowledge. Okay? You need to use their experiences, their previous experiences, whether it's in the classroom or their life, and build on that, connect to this. Now, good teachers are going to do much of this instinctively. Yes, I know that. But all the more reason why we need to spell it out so that you do it automatically. One of the ways I like to do this, even with my 10th graders, is introducing TR, is to bring in a teddy bear. A teddy bear. Oh, maybe the lights are going off for you for the first time. Teddy bear? What's the point? Or have you ever seen Mount Rushmore? Four presidents there. Do you know who they are? Okay, so getting some kind of link to previous knowledge. Knowledge that they're prior to aware of. The teddy bear works really well when I get to talk to the second graders about Theodore Roosevelt, which I get to do. Do you have a teddy bear? Why does it have that name? I've had some interesting experiences with that. I had them all, as a preparation, bring in their bears the day before I came to talk. And so they have them when I come in. And I made the mistake the first time of saying, so-and-so come up here and, what have you got there? My stuffed bear? Say, yeah, and what's it called? Frank, I don't know what it was, but it sure wasn't Teddy. Oh, wow. Okay. We had some work to do. So, didn't work with second grade. Needed to find something more common with that. So, teddy bears work as an introduction. It links to something they already know. Communicate the grammar of the new material. This is the rule, one rule. Communicate the grammar of the new material in planned steps. Start with what they know. Okay? Known to unknown. Find out what they know. Sometimes it's a very dangerous thing to assume that they'll all know this, and so I'll just go from there. Very honestly, you don't know unless you ask. Assuming is a very dangerous business in the teaching world. It really is. And I often say to the 10th graders, you know, pardon me if I'm insulting your intelligence, but let's find out if you know this. I use that expression literally. And I mean it. I'm sorry if I'm insulting your intelligence, but let's see if you know this. And frankly, I see some relieved expressions when we go through it. Okay. The law, I'm not going to review right now. Well, all right, yes, we will. Got to do it. First law, of course, is the teacher must what? No, all right, quickly. The learner must what? With? Okay, the law of the language must be common to both. Very good. The law of the lesson, start from to the... See, look at that, you guys are great. Okay, the law of the teaching process. Teaching is arousing and using the pupil's mind to grasp the desired thought or master the desired art. Okay, I don't know if it's still popular. It's been a while since I've been in the College of Education, but there was a thing called TWSBAT, T-S-W-B-A-T, it stood for the student will be able to. Does that sound familiar? Anyway, that was very popular as a methodology for lesson planning when I was there. And so all the emphasis was on something observable that the student would be able to do by the end of the lesson. And I really don't like that very much. It makes it sound like, you know, this is everything is going to be visible outcomes. And outcome-based education was tied very much into this whole thing. No, the work of the planning of the lesson and the teaching process is the teacher's job. Okay? Is the teacher's job. And you need to figure out how to arouse their interest and use their brains. Okay, so here, give me a sample rule. Excite and direct the self-activities of the pupil. And what Gregory says is generally, if possible, tell them nothing that they could find out for themselves. Now, that's going to take a bit of work, and I realize for particularly teachers at the grammar stage, that's asking a bit. So he's not wooden about that, so don't try to do any of these things woodenly. But particularly at the dialectic level, the logic level, this is a really good idea. In other words, framing good questions for these young reasoners is a real good application of this. It gets their brains working. Using why a lot, and that's going to come in into both of these. This is the teacher's job, though. So, for instance, another way, both at the dialectic or maybe the rhetoric level, is assigning further study, individual study. In the life of TR, there are plenty of things I'm not going to have time to get through, even in the 4 days I take with him. So assigning further study is a good way of getting them to discover more about him. Did you know that he was shot when he was running for president in 1912? It's the stuff of legends. It's the stuff of legends. And that he was nearly killed by a runaway trolley car, 1902. This sort of thing, it really is the stuff of legends. And I want them to know why he's bigger than life. Okay, we need to move on. A violation of that is, of course, not planning for their work, thinking that it's all about you. You do all the work. And frankly, you're denying them the opportunity to learn. Do not do that. Sometime in every lesson, there should be something they do. Ta-da. See, that's why you're filling in things. Number six, the law of the teaching process. Learning is reproducing into one's own thinking a new idea or truth, or working into habit a new art or skill. This, of course, is the flip side of the student's job. Okay, excuse me, the teacher's job. This is what the student's brain is hopefully doing. Or, yes, their habit. I teach art as well as history, and so I want them to do certain things that we've studied with our brushes. We've practiced with our watercolor brushes. I want them to practice certain techniques. How do I know they get it? They do it. That's kind of how that goes. All right? So, in other words, he's saying again, if this doesn't happen, if the student isn't basically digesting this internally, mentally, nothing's really going to stick. It's going to be the old, what do I have to do to get an A on this test? Is this going to be on the test? That's where that you know, that's how long that's going to stick in that Teflon pan of their brain. It's out because the test is done. A sample rule, keep in mind the level of the students, of course. What's it going to take to have them do this? Grammar teachers are very creative about this. This is a little bit more of an area where secondary teachers, logic and rhetoric teachers, are apt to fail. Okay? Not allowing the students to do this. Why should be a very frequent question, particularly at the logic level. Why? Why do you think that? Why did battleship diplomacy work? Why do you think Theodore Roosevelt had such a strong moral code? What do you think propelled his thinking? All his biographers write that way. He was against corruption. He was against bribes and injustice. Why? Why do you think that? Why do you think that was? Okay. A sample violation, of course, is haste and or too much to do. Haste and or too much to do. What does that do? That robs reflection. That robs time to think, to process. Writing, everybody knows this, writing is one of the best ways of determining how much a student really understands, isn't it? And particularly at the older level, it is fantastic, a fantastic way of finding out what they know and how well they understand it and, frankly, how well they can express it at the rhetoric level. Why don't we do more writing? Well, son of a gun, we're teachers. We have to grade it. I know this. You know full well when you hand something out, it's going to come back and it's going to have writing on it. And then you have to do something with it. And if you have 20 kids, you have to do it 20 times. That's how it works. And so that's why we don't do it. Okay, we need to find a way around that. So, haste or too much to do. Okay, and the last law. The last law. The law of review and application. A number of little things to fill in. The test and proof of teaching gun, the finishing and fastening process, I like that, must be a reviewing, rethinking, re-knowing, reproducing, and applying of the material that has been taught, the knowledge and ideals and arts that have been communicated. You may have already heard the expression, we use it a lot at Logos. Yes, ma'am. I sure can. The test and proof of teaching done, the finishing and fastening, as in a button, process must be a reviewing, rethinking, re-knowing, reproducing, and applying of the material that has been taught, the knowledge and ideals and arts that have been communicated. Does that help? Review, review, review. If you wondered where that expression came from, it's Gregory. You may not have known that. He uses it. Review, review, review. Especially at the beginning and end, particularly if you're going to have to forsake something, okay, forsake it at the end, and then pick it up the first thing the next time. Not that you should do that, but seriously, reviewing at the beginning of the period is more valuable if you have to give up one than at the end. At the end, let's be honest, their attention factor is way down. All right? If you have the time, great. But definitely at the beginning of every new period, every new day, bring them back to what you accomplished the day before or the lesson before. All right? Don't wait until it's right before the test. Don't wait right before the end of the semester. Of course, that's a good time to review. We require, for instance, before our finals for the secondary students, 3 days of review, 3 periods of review for every subject. There is no sacrifice of that. Don't even dream of teaching right up to the test. If you didn't finish, too bad. Review, review, review. Because it just makes sense. If you're familiar with John Saxon of Saxon Math, this is where he made his millions. Totally true. The only real new thing he did in bringing a math text was that he included review. Lots of it. And he made, well, he's dead, but he made lots of money. Okay? a sample rule. Seek out ways to apply prior knowledge, not just a test. Now, tests aren't bad, but think of more creative ways. You can do that. All right? Again, as a history teacher, T.R. lived until 1919, but his influence is with us still today. As I go through the 20th century and now into the 21st century, it's not hard for me to bring his reference back. And I do that not just because I like him, but because it's true. And every time I refer to him, that makes it that much more solid for the kids. Oh, he did that. Oh, that's right, he did that. Okay, so incorporating it. I'm not testing them there. Okay, of course, a sample violation is not doing it. That's a tough one to figure out. Or waiting till the end of a semester or a quarter and then blasting them with this major review. No. Digesting it slowly. Okay, I refer to KICKER, pretty lame, but it's the best acronym I could come up with, for remembering the seven laws. So I'll run through it very quickly. K, referring to the first law, for know, as in K-N-O-W. I, for interest. Tend with interest. C, for common knowledge, of the language. K, for known to the unknown. E, for excite. This is, again, the work of the student, but the teacher plans it. R, for what happens in the student's brain, the reproduction of the thought, the first R, and the second R, of course, review. Kicker. If you come up with a better one, let me know. How are these dovetail with classical methodology? Well, of course, you'll see this in reading the book. Gregory offers us another view of a time when teaching, like a lot of philosophically based endeavors, was unabashedly absolutist. That means there's a right way and a wrong way of doing it. In other words, it really does matter whether you do it right or wrong. Like classical instruction, these laws have been with us for some time, just not in an accepted or maybe even a palatable form. But they work, and they work well. A systematic approach to teaching is only dull and dry if the teacher makes it so. If you try to apply these laws woodenly, or you have an administrator that tries to whack you over the head with them, it's not going to be very pleasant, and they won't work. No, these need to be embraced. He also implies, like I said before, Sayers, that you need to pay attention to the characteristics of the students, the frames of the students. Gregory mentions this in quite a few places. I won't try to go through all of them. But he was very acquainted with children of all levels. He knew it really mattered what the frame of the child was. Okay? He used that to his advantage. He even has, and I'll mention this in the book, on page 130, he has kind of a breakdown of very similar type of thing that Sayers refers to in the Lost Tools of Learning. He refers to their ages and kind of what their characteristics are. He makes a point of the integration and the sequencing of material. Very important to classical understanding, too. Classical instruction, the sequence and integration of material. We believe there is a universe, not a multiverse. Therefore, we can find how things interrelate. Okay? He makes a big point of that, too. And, of course, sequencing. Well, what's that? Well, a lot of it is review. A sequenced reading program, a sequenced math program, a sequenced history program, all of it, of course, is going to be review. Let's start with the known, and move to the unknown. Now we're in fifth grade. Start with the known, move to the unknown. Finally, here's the point. Teachers need a fixed beacon for determining their bearings. They need to know that their skills are not assumed or lacking in any way to grow. The seven laws provide a quantifiable means for both the administrators and teachers to measure a teacher's skills and successes. And, yes, their failures. The scriptures say that teachers will be held to a stricter judgment. Even the world recognizes this in some manner. What more compelling reason do we need to strive to be teaching well, to be teaching effectively, out of an overflowing heart for the students? This book will make you a better teacher when applied religiously. anything. Last note, crass salesmanship. We have both the book. Logos developed a workbook to go with it. This is particularly helpful to new teachers to slowly work through the seven laws and apply them to their own lessons. Thank you, and have a good lunch.